Hello, and welcome to another lovely bonus episode of the Lines Up by Donkeys podcast. I'm Joe, doing my best NPR voice, and with me is Liam.
Oh man, I am so soothed right now.
I'm just going to fall asleep while podcasting.
Stephen Breyer doesn't need to retire. Hashtag girl boss.
Unlike the premium series of the history of Armenia, I do like my best announcer voice while I read, because I don't have a guest. It has been so deeply weird to me to have to do that. And then people actually notice the difference. Like, shit, fuck, I still don't know what I'm doing.
Oh, I never know what I'm doing. So I feel you. I even on There's a Problem, I'm just like, am I supposed to talk now? Like 85 episodes in. Sometimes I do it the most inopportune times. That's Liam, baby.
That has been one of the weirdest parts. So like for the first 100 episodes, I think more. This podcast is all done in person.
Yes.
Nick and I were across the table, and like, so you can kind of see how when someone's going to react, so you just don't get cut off. In going to doing this over distance, since we moved, and you know, doing more distance when I move again, even further away, it's definitely changed the dynamic a bit. And I know some podcasts record over video, so you can see each other, and I don't have enough USB plugs to actually plug in my camera while I'm recording. So I can't do that.
I can't relate, as I have a gaming PC.
I have a gaming laptop.
Oh, that's not.
I move too much.
That sounds like a personal problem.
Honestly is, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Liam, there is something of like a holy grail of episodes of this podcast. And they are ones that people have been asking for since we started. Not since we started, since people actually listened to us, which was a little bit after we started. And one of those is the football war. Have you ever heard of the football war?
I have heard of it, but I know nothing about it beyond the name.
Honestly, that is most people. The name is catchy. It seemingly wraps it up into a nice tight bow, like, oh, this war is caused by football, and it wasn't.
Yeah, a football war true thing, man.
Yeah, it's like all of the other like funny names that come from battles or wars, like, nah, it's got to be more than that, and it is.
Joe was lying to you, people.
It is partially started by fruit companies, racism, and a little bit of nationalism in sport, something that we as Americans are very familiar with.
Yeah, because we're the best at it.
Oh, certainly not soccer.
Women's soccer, you fucking sexist.
Last time I checked, we lost in the Olympics.
Oh, yeah. Back-to-back-to-back World Cup champs. But yeah, you know, you're right, Joe.
But you couldn't go back-to-back-to-back-to-back. You didn't want it enough.
it's because of the trans kids, goddammit.
It's the women's team is great. And they should be paid significantly more than the men's team, who have won nothing.
Who are bad. Who are just fucking bad. Yeah. You should get rewarded for it. It's all these people who are like, oh, well, they don't make as much money, but are also like, participation trophy generation. It's like, one or the other, man. Come on.
Yeah, but they draw more money. Like, who gives a fuck? I don't care. It's only because of ads.
They suck ass.
The reason why the men's soccer team draws viewers is because they're playing teams better than themselves. That's why whenever you go to, like, a U.S. men's soccer game in person, you see, like, the other nation's jersey more than your own.
Yeah.
Like, it's like when you have a shitty sport, like being a Lions fan in Detroit, you don't go to actually watch the Lions. You go because like the Packers are in town and you can see what a good quarterback looks like.
Jared Goff held it together for two quarters yesterday.
Oh, fuck him. And not that I think Matt Stafford is very good. I think he is very overrated. I mean, the man who was throwing to Calvin Johnson legitimately won the best receivers in NFL history and still couldn't win a fucking playoff game. Anyway.
Welcome back to what is ostensibly a history podcast.
Welcome back as I get progressively more angry at Detroit sports. Now, of course, that means we're talking about the football war, which was fought between noted military powerhouses El Salvador and Honduras. Now, in reality, as always, the real reason for this war is a lot deeper and a lot more ingrained into these two nations and people think, and it certainly wasn't caused by the World Cup qualifiers, though we will talk about that. Of all of the things the World Cup has caused, this is not one of them. Slavery, yes. Covering up murders, yes. Various other crimes, Absolutely. War, not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But they're gonna.
They're absolutely going to. If the World Cup and FIFA is like the most corrupt sports like body
yeah.
in world history. Like even boxing yeah. is like, damn.
Do you remember a few years ago when a bunch of those FIFA guys got arrested by like US marshals, but in Switzerland for some reason?
Yeah.
It's like, I know
yeah.
the United States shouldn't get involved in other countries' affairs. Like,
it's the only way the US is ever going to win anything in FIFA is by arresting people.
But it was funny as shit to watch like US marshals frog march all these fucking bastards.
The one time you have to hand it to the cops, I guess.
Yes.
That's like, America sucks at soccer, but you know what we do have? Cops. Cops literally everywhere.
We'll level this playing field one way or the goddamn other.
If America ever wins a World Cup, it's because somebody last Boy Scouted their way across the field. And it's just like the whole team is made of the NYPD. Now, this war started in 1969. Nice. But nice. It goes back much, much, much further. And kind of sort of is based on really badly thought out land reform plans. Obviously, El Salvador and Honduras border one another. El Salvador is much, much smaller than Honduras, with Honduras being about five times as large. But El Salvador is much more populated. It is very densely populated, leading to all kinds of problems. But this also meant that Honduras had a ton of land with the added benefit of not being as shitty of a regime as El Salvador had at the time. That is not me handing it to the government of Honduras.
That was a lot of qualifiers stacked on top of each other.
Like, because Honduras at this time isn't as bad, but they will become virtually identical.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Lions love my donkeys, baby.
Yeah. El Salvador at the time had a government that the U.S. pretty much stuck in place and funded for decades, as long as they just remained anti-communist. Of course, this, as always, took form in the shape of death squads and mass peasant murder. Because that's generally what happens with those things, right?
Fucking great.
By the 1960s, nearly 500,000 Salvadorans had crossed the border into Honduras, eventually making up around 20% of the total Honduran population.
Oh, wow.
Now, technically, these people were illegal immigrants, but nobody cared or intended to do anything about it. Now, you could say it's because the state lacked the ability to do something about it, but like most people who immigrate illegally, they have a net positive upon wherever it is they immigrate because they do things and work in places that the native population simply won't or doesn't want to for whatever reason. America, looking at you. Also, the concept of illegal immigration is stupid.
Hard to agree there. Yeah, my favorite is like, well, it's like, well, they should get jabs. It's like, they're taking our job. I'm like, motherfucker, you do not want to be out in the cornfields making $11 an hour.
Of course not.
Breaking your fucking back. Like, I know you don't, you fucking liars.
This happened in Alabama, of all places. This is before 2016, I believe. My date could be fucked up. But the local government came down hard on illegal immigration, chased all of the illegal immigrants off the fields, and they went and worked somewhere else with the idea of, they were going to replace these workers with Americans, and nobody took the jobs.
That's crazy how that works.
The pay is really, really bad. Also, maybe fix that part of this equation. Pay people better. Let them join unions. Also, maybe they should own the farms. But so they end up having to replace it with prison labor, slavery.
Hey, Alabama! Oh, well, at least they have a nice appreciation for history.
Yeah. And the prisoners obviously didn't want to fucking do this job either, so they simply didn't, leading to massive crop failures. So guess what happened then? The state stopped caring so much about illegal immigration anymore.
That's funny how that works.
It's weird. Now, enter one of the most vile corporations in all of the Western world.
Oh, man, this is a toughie. Give me Chiquita.
And I'll head this off by saying it is not the British East India Company.
Oh, okay. Give me Dole.
Close. The United Fruit Company.
Yeah.
A somehow worse UFC. obviously there's Chiquita and all these other things that also occur during this time on and way before this, like to the point that that's why Chiquita changed their name.
Yes.
It's also why the UFC would eventually change their name as well. Like, ooh, we don't want to be pinned to that. Now, Dole has all sorts of other baggage, namely the island I'm sitting on. And trust me, we'll talk about that eventually. Now, this UFC had a long history of fucking around in Latin America to the extent it could eventually be an episode or a series unto its own. Generally, they're called the Fruit Wars or the Banana Wars. It's like that's where the term Banana Republic comes from.
Right.
So, like, there's a whole lot of history there. So I can't go into all of it here.
All of it bad.
Yeah. So stay tuned. We'll eventually talk about it. I know someone's like, well, you forgot about this part. Yes, I did, because I cut it out. Because otherwise, this is going for like hours before I even get to the 60s.
Yeah, we'll get there. We will get there.
Read about it amongst yourselves. I'll catch up. Now, this had been going on ever since the country had become independent all the way in 1838. At the time, Honduras's economy was in tatters, and the president, a guy named Marco Soto, was looking for a way to get companies to invest money into the country. So he came up with the Agrarian Law of 1877. That would gift land and tax benefits to any multinational company that would show up and give Honduras money.
Uh-oh.
Enter the Vaccaro brothers and company, along with an American banana guy named Samuel Zamuri, who would begin a long and solid tradition of fruit companies fucking around in Honduran politics. And Honduras is not alone here. I'm just talking about Honduras specifically right now. This is more of a continental problem, unfortunately.
More of a vibe, if you will.
Yeah. At one point, when the deal of 1877 might have changed somewhat, Zamuri bought a former American gunboat named the Hornet, called it a yacht, filled it full of gang members he bought off in New Orleans, and invaded the country in order to put General Manuel Bonilla in power to ensure nobody would come after his sweet, sweet banana money.
Jesus, fuck. I'd do part of this and just, Jesus, wept.
It, like, the dude, there's fuck you money, and then there's gunboat money.
Gunboat yacht, gunboat yacht.
gunboat yacht, gunboat yacht. Oh, by the way, I rented all these gangsters from New Orleans. Like, imagine being like a street dude in New Orleans, like a mobster or whatever, and someone's like, hey, I got an idea. Like, oh, you want to like sell drugs or bootleg booze or smuggle cigarettes? Like, no, I need you to invade a country. Like, we just have to go talk to Joey Invades Countries.
Yeah. Oh, Joey Big Hands.
he's got a coup guy. Now, the banana yacht-based invasion failed in the short term, but in the long term, the president of Honduras was forced to step down, and eventually, that same guy, Bonilla, won in the next elections.
Won or won in quotes?
It's definitely in quotes. Pretty much everybody has accepted that the vote was completely rigged by UFC banana agents. A sentence I never thought I was going to say.
UFC banana agents. World history is so fucked.
This land had never legally been owned before. Like, it's very common throughout human history that indigenous populations don't do land ownership, right? Now, once in power, Bonilla gave UFC more and more and more tax breaks, land, and concessions to the point they were pretty much the government. So instead, it was like a communal farmland used by communities. The land was just communally owned. Kind of.
Right.
So the state decided, since these communities did not legally own this land, they could just give it to fruit companies who would then legally own it with or without any input from local populations or communities that had been farming these places for generations.
Hell, it's all this time.
The same thing actually happened with the Dole plantations here on Oahu. It happened pretty much everywhere there's fruit companies. They're all kind of shit.
Yeah, apparently.
The state also did this to local Honduran farmers. They did this to the El Salvadoran immigrants, because the immigrants certainly didn't legally own the land, right? They were the Salvadorans were working land that nobody else wanted to work. Like, it was shit land. But they also did it to Honduran farmers who did not legally own the land they were farming, because, like I said, this is not normal, like land ownership, not a normal part of Honduran society before the fucking banana people showed up.
Right.
Now, the fruit company would either swallow this land up themselves, turn it into company-run plantations, or the state would give it to them, and then the local farmers would continue working that land as long as they became contractors and have no choice but to sell whatever crops came out of the ground to the company at fucking cut-rate prices, all but guaranteeing they'd be destitutely in poverty and have to stay there. Sharecropping, pretty much.
Right. Right.
Also, that fruit company that they sold to would be the only ones allowed to distribute crops that they farmed.
Right.
So, yeah. Of course, the companies would undercut them incredibly bad while charging high prices on the other side, meaning that they just became incredibly rich. This meant that people in Honduras would work their ass off on the land and be giving virtually no money, while the companies became worth billions. Whenever people attempted to unionize or resist this obvious bullshit, they would be crushed. Their lands were taken, and for a long time, being in a union was just illegal, as the local dictator worked for the fruit companies to exploit their own people. This is all just like things that people already kind of knew.
Nefarious genocidal maniac 101, yeah.
Yeah. But don't worry, that dictator was eventually replaced by democracy in the 1950s.
Again, is this democracy or democracy in quotes?
Democracy light. It's better than the dictator. We're grading on a curve.
We celebrate what we can here on Lions Led by Donkeys.
Now, to the surprise of probably nobody, this new president was a former lawyer of the fruit companies and was elected president and then continued doing the same exact shit that the previous dictator did, only to be overthrown in a military coup in 1963 that would also continue the same policies with all the frilly democracy details.
Wow, who could have seen that coming?
You know who this happened to be supported by? The CIA.
Hey. our old friends, the CIA.
Also the FBI, weirdly enough.
Why?
I don't know. You expect the CIA. Like whenever I tell anybody on this podcast, the CIA did, everyone's like, well, yeah, of course
they did. Yeah, of course they did. Right.
But you don't expect the FBI to come in to like tag team Honduras.
Well, and you know, it's crazy because there's always that interagency rivalry. I'm glad they settled their differences for this one.
The only thing that can settle the differences between the FBI and CIA is doing a coup in Latin America. It's like a rom-com, but with firing squads.
He's FBI. She's CIA. Going soon to theaters. What do you mean forced disappearance?
Instead of Lady and the Tramp, where they like meet kissing over spaghetti, they like go to grab an AK to shoot a farmer and their hands touch.
They romantically try to shove a cyanide pill in someone's mouth.
You suicide people, too?
Wow, we have so much in common.
Now, obviously, after doing this for...
canceled, Joe.
It's impossible. You can't cancel me. That's not true. They're jokes, people. They're jokes.
Stop yelling at us.
Eventually, people got sick of this shit, right? And they wanted to fight back. They wanted to get the right to unionize and start arguing for the return of the lands that the fruit companies had stolen, which by the mid-1960s owned pretty much all of the good land in the country. And it was about 10% of the entire country's land mass in total. And that's what they directly owned. That is not counting all of the contract spots. So, they directly owned 10% of Honduras.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Eventually, even the fruit companies realized, oh, man, we pissed people off. We're about to lose this sweet deal that we have. And people might, overthrow the dictator. They're like, we have to do something. We have to do something quick. So they got racist.
Great. fucking great.
Who needs to reform when you can just be racist? They began a full PR campaign against the Salvadoran immigrant community who had moved into the country and farmed the land that literally nobody else wanted. They also blamed the Salvadorans for coming in and stealing the jobs of the Hondurans. That old hat.
All reliable.
like flipping through the racism dictionary, they took our jobs and just underlining it. Now, their main talking point was that If it wasn't for all these goddamn Salvadorans, there would be enough land and jobs for everyone. Clearly, this is not the fault of me, your friendly neighborhood banana baron. with the death squads and the yacht gunboat.
Gunboat yacht, Joe.
Yeah. Like, you must direct your attention away from us, your banana warlord. When the government began planning a land reform bill, the fruit company swooped in to make sure that if any land got reformed, it would absolutely was none of the shit that they owned. Only the land they contracted out that was being farmed by someone else entirely, rather than being controlled, they kind of allowed the government to do that. Because it gave the government legitimacy to, like, see, look, we're fighting the banana companies. And to be clear, the contracted lands was the worst ones that they owned.
Gotcha.
So they're like, no, we're not going to give you the good stuff. We can't do that. Now, the various ultra-powerful fruit companies banded together to create a fake union called the National Federation of Farmers and Livestock Farmers of Honduras. Despite none of them being Honduran or farmers, all of these guys were white. And they were all based out of the country and just fucking around on the outside. Using the combined power that they had, they pressured the government, which is led by a former general they had helped put into power, that they wanted the land reform bill to look a certain type of way. Now, this pressure led to one of the weirdest land reform laws of all time in 1962. Though, while that passed in 62, it would not take effect until 1967. This country would take the lands worked but probably not legally owned by any non-native born Honduran, not counting the fruit companies, which were decidedly not Honduran.
Cool.
Almost all of these people were Salvadoran, and then they would redistribute them to Hondurans.
Sounds foolproof to me.
This is assuming, of course, that the land was not legally owned in any way by any fruit company. This meant that the only land that was being redistributed would be barely workable land that the Salvadorans had been barely scratching out an existence on and being used by... They were desperately poor and hungry. Like, they weren't making a lot of money farming this land.
Subsistence farming, right.
Yeah, it was like one step above that. While the UFC would continue to own most farmland in the entire country, as well as, you know, owning the government. Now, we have talked about this stuff before where a government, or in this case, a collection of international companies that may as well be the government, starts ramping up anti-whoever, in this case, Salvadoran propaganda. We know what happens next. Racist violence.
Ooh.
Ooh, we did it. Oh, God.
Ugh, Christ.
In the run-up to the land reform, these fruit companies spent lavishly on propaganda painting the Salvadorans as the reason for their problems in Honduras. Of course, this led to pissed-off Hondurans committing waves of hate crimes against their neighbors and people they previously never had any problem with.
Right.
When the Salvadorans officially lost their lands as a result of land reform, tens of thousands of them decided to pack up and go back to El Salvador because... what the fuck else are they going to do in Honduras?
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Like, why am I going to stay here? Clearly, this place is racist as hell. Salvador at this point was straining badly, overcrowded, no infrastructure investment, terrible government. So all of these people moving back strained it even more. Not to mention, then, like now, a huge part of the Salvadoran economy is based on migrant workers sending money back home. So all of these people losing land and their jobs and their way of making money, losing all that had a massive impact on the Salvadoran economy, which was already fucked. Now, the other part of their economy was coffee, and that was owned by 14 families, and they, like all good rich people, sent their money elsewhere. None of that trickled down to the mass population of the poor in the country. The government, which benefited from that arrangement, didn't want to draw attention to this, so they blamed Honduras. Doing the exact thing Honduras was doing.
That's novel.
Like, oh, fuck, the Hondurans are stealing your money as they let you, like, do a burnout in your family.
I'm your friendly neighborhood fruit baron. Pay no attention to the gunboat yacht.
It's just us, your friendly neighborhood coffee dictators. Now, this is met on both sides, from like the coffee in Honduras shipped from El Salvador and Honduran guns shipped into El Salvador, was like met with boycotts on both sides and various attempts at embargoes. A Honduran newspaper said not buying Salvadoran goods and instead buying Honduran should be a point of national pride.
Oh boy. That was a good side.
I don't know what the Honduran version of Freedom Fries would be, but like, it's that. They're doing that. Then, on the other side of the border, Salvadorans fueled by the media and government matched their Honduran counterparts with various screeds of nationalist and racist hate-filled rhetoric. Some even began to claim that the land that was being worked by Salvadorans all of those years had been stolen and had been stolen by the Honduran government should be legally and rightfully considered part of El Salvador and should be taken back by force. This is the irredentist take. They were never part of Honduras. Like, maybe of fucking 300-400 years ago. So, with the two countries at each other's throats from a mixture of nationalist propaganda and fruit company racism, it brings us to where a lot of people think this war began, a game of soccer. Now, World Cup soccer, to be more specific, in June of 1969, Honduras was slated to face El Salvador in the 1970 World Cup qualifiers, which, in retrospect, is kind of fucked up for FIFA to do.
That's kind of par for the course of these boys, though.
Like, that would be like if during the World Cup qualifiers right now, Armenia and Azerbaijan would play each other. Like, maybe mix them up a bit, you fucking assholes. Like, there's going to be problems. This is weird even for FIFA. The first game held in the capital city of, Tegucigalpa?
Sure.
Yeah, sorry, guys. I tried. I even had it broken up in, like, pronunciation blocks. It's a hard city to pronounce for an American like me. I'm dumb. The Honduran capital city. Now, this ended in a victory for Honduras, but the entire thing was marred by people in crowds beating the absolute shit out of each other in various forms of, like, weapons and soccer hooliganism.
Yeah, that good shit.
And, like, also, like, various forms of like, harassment, even if, like, you were too far away to be directly assaulted. Like, just people screaming at one another. It was nuts. Even for a soccer game in the 1960s, it was nuts. This wasn't one side on the other. This is mutual, I do have to point out. For instance, the El Salvadoran side were kept up all night by riotous fans outside their hotel and were nearly lynched on their way to the game.
Jesus, fuck.
At one point, the stadium was set on fire and a Salvadoran woman committed suicide in the shame of defeat.
Holy shit.
Now, that part is maybe not true, but it was certainly the story the government told. The next game held in El Salvador, because FIFA doesn't learn their fucking lesson, got even more crazy. Since the last game, Salvadoran media had been using the violence and death of that woman for propaganda. Her funeral was broadcast on national TV alongside various screeds of racist shit against Hondurans. When the Honduran team reached the airport in El Salvador, they were immediately accosted by hordes of Salvadoran fans. Fans singled out the Honduras' star player, a guy named Enrique the Rabbit Cardona, and held up posters of him being beaten by a rabbit, which is admittedly kind of funny. Like, a rabbit with, like, a baseball bat was beating him up. Or a club. That's how you should harass a sports fan. Not, like, physically.
Yeah, not trying to lynch people. Don't do that part. Yeah,
lynching? Bad. Many people are saying this. Now, the night before the game, General Jose Alberto Medrano led fans of El Salvador in, a riotous march through the streets, hoping to disturb the Honduran team's sleep and affect their performance the next day. They attacked anyone on the street they thought might be Honduran. At the end of the night, two men lay dead in the street. At some point in the night, the Honduran players were escorted out of the hotel and taken to safety at their own embassy.
Jesus, what?
This is before the game.
Don't play the game.
Just cancel the game. Two people have already died. Three people have died. Now, during the match the next day, the effects of the previous night's riots were seen on the pitch. In an undisclosed location before the match, the players were tired and feared for their lives. During the pregame ritual, Honduras' flag was not flown. In a show of spite, the Salvadorans hung a rag to which the Hondurans sung their national anthem. To the surprise of nobody in a situation like this, El Salvador won! After the match, the Salvadorans celebrated, and there were, again, riots in the streets, but this time out of joy rather than loathing.
Oh, God.
Enrique Cardona, the Honduran soccer player, said, quote, "We're awfully lucky that we lost, otherwise they would have killed us." what's incredible here is at no point did the soccer players do this to one another. Like, they're professionals. Like, they're like, sorry, guys. Like, I mean, I'm sure they have their own personal biases and prejudices, whatever. They're human. But, like, at no point were people, like, taking cheap shots at one another. They were totally normal outside of, you know, everything surrounding them. As the two sides were tied, there would have to be a third match. And thankfully, in order to head off all of this violence and lynching and riots, FIFA decided to be held in Mexico City.
There you go.
It took three people dying and multiple like assaults for them to be like, maybe this is bad. But a day before the match was set to begin, the Salvadoran government cut all official ties with Honduras, citing the fact that the government had done absolutely nothing to punish people who, in their words, had committed genocide against Salvadorans within Honduras. This is all of the hate crimes and chasing people back across the border that they're talking about. Now, I can say that this is not considered to be a genocide in the field currently, but even without that definition, what happened was fucking terrible. And the Honduran government had done nothing about it. They seemed like cops and soldiers were taking part in it.
Whoa, no way, dude! That's crazy.
Yeah, weird how that always happens. Now, violence was committed by local gangs assisted by cops and soldiers in Honduras as they terrorized Salvadoran settlers, trying to drive them out of neighborhoods and back into El Salvador. If the settlers refused to leave, Hondurans burned their houses to the ground. The Salvadoran media did not take kindly to this turn of events. One Salvadoran newspaper reported these events stated, quote, El Salvador should civilize Honduras by force.
Oh, good.
Now, by the time of the third game, in just the period that these games have been going on, because things have been escalating the whole time in Honduras through violence.
Sure.
Not directly connected to soccer. Didn't help. But so during this time, tens of thousands of people had fled Honduras just during these games. Now, when the third game started in Mexico City, border clashes between the two sides had already begun.
Hell of a pregame.
Right. Pregame ritual. Everybody get your rifle.
Yeah, that's what we do for a tailgate, actually. We blow up a table.
The game ended in a 3-2 Salvadoran victory in overtime. When you read little clips of this war online, many people think that, you know, it started with the final whistle of the soccer game, but it didn't. The third game was held on June 27th, and a few weeks went by as El Salvador built up its military on the border. Honduras did the same, though their military was much, much smaller.
Right.
One of those things about being a military dictator is you tend to really like the military. So El Salvador, with American money, had built up quite a bit of weapons and soldiers.
We did it, America. Bastion of freedom, baby.
Now, around the 1950s, the U.S., as always during the era and beyond, really wanted to support anyone who hated communism, or at least said they did on the surface. The way they support them was by dumping World War II era surplus weapons and vehicles on their doorstep with the occasional touch of death squad training and probably Langley or something.
Nah, dude, down near Williamsburg.
Yeah.
Yeah, you go, it's, I've been there. Not because I'm part of the CIA. I took a wrong turn with my dad.
Liam took some death squad training at the School of the Americas.
Yeah. Oh, Fort Benning. What are you doing here?
I know it's not what you meant, but there's something deeply hilarious about an El Salvadoran death squad training in Colonial Williamsburg.
Yeah. No, it's literally right outside Williamsburg on the York River. In case you were ever curious.
Just for some weekend events.
A man will come out and yell at you. Don't worry. Oh,
that's unfortunate. Sir, I am here to learn how to shoot unarmed people. The police academy is down the street. These agreements helped the U.S. in a lot of ways, too. These weapons would be used to crush revolts, which are almost always leftist in nature. And if that failed, they got rid of a whole bunch of junky old weapons they couldn't use anymore. Like, you couldn't even sell these to anybody. It's the fucking 50s and 60s. These weapons are old as shit. Like, this meant in 1969, things like the P-51 Mustang, the Corsair, and the M3 Stuart tank would ride again for the last time. Like, these are old fucking weapons, man. Now, I should point out that most of the small arms and tanks were just given, but the planes were a little bit weirder. Now, the U.S. didn't really have all of these planes to give away. And the ones that they had were pretty beaten up. Like, they were just thrown in a scrap heap. You couldn't fly them. But you know who did have them? Plane nerds.
Oh, no.
The government of El Salvador purchased these from private collectors.
Avgeeks are the fucking worst, dude.
Like, it was just a whole bunch of rich people that had P-51s laying around.
God damn, I fucking hate Avgeeks. Be into trains. Fuck.
It's the eternal battle between plane geeks and train geeks.
God fucking hate. Avgeeks are the worst, man. They're all just like, ooh, Tails, shut the fuck up.
See, this is going to be significantly more controversial than us making jokes about a CIA and FBI romance. Planes are fine. Hey, at least they're not helicopter geeks.
Oh, those 20,000 moving parts looking for a place to crash.
Those private collectors and stuff, like, you can still do this. Like, yeah. There's jokes about it online. I get tagged and stuff all the time about buying tanks that, like, they're quote unquote demilitarized, but it's literally like a couple welds that weld a breech block closed that you can very easily repurpose into a weapon. Now, most of these were decommissioned and mothballed and, you know, museum pieces, but, you know, they were very, very quickly brought back in working order.
Right.
It does not take a lot to get a P-51 Mustang running. That is not exactly the height of flight science in the 60s. They were bought as civilian aircraft or museum pieces and then turned into warplanes, which is very illegal. Nobody seemed to care.
Brown people killing each other, man.
To be fair, nobody gives a shit about international law anyway.
No.
Like, international law is more of a vibe until, like, someone decides that you've done something that's beyond the pale. Yeah, and, like, sometimes it's not even genocide. If you're Rwanda or Azerbaijan, you can have a little genocide as a treat, and the international community doesn't give a fuck. Or Ethiopia, for that matter. Or China. Nobody cares.
As long as you don't do it too loud, basically.
Yeah, exactly. If you're going to do it quietly or do it to a country that nobody cares about or a group of people that nobody cares about. And you better not fuck with the money. Don't fuck with the money. Otherwise, the UN will suddenly care.
You will be invaded.
Yeah, if you fuck with the money, you will be liberated. Now, we're not talking about hundreds of planes like you would probably imagine a war to be fought with. Instead, they're around like a dozen on each side. Prop planes from World War II.
Please tell me there were dogfights.
Oh, we'll get there. Yes. Now, pretty much all of these were Korean War surplus, which were World War II surplus for the most part. And so, like, others were trainer aircraft, like the Mustang II that they actually got, like, functioning was repurposed as a trainer aircraft they purchased to train their Air Force, and they slapped machine guns on it.
Gotta do what you gotta do, I suppose.
Yeah, 100%. Unfortunately, you know who else is trying to do this? Eric Prince, the Blackwater guy.
At the same time?
No. He isn't born yet, I don't think.
Okay.
He has attempted to build a mercenary Air Force so many different times. And that's like the one thing that's illegal for him to do is strap bombs onto like a Cessna. You can't do that.
Grind never stops, though. So,
but again, like we already talked about, nobody ever holds Eric Prince accountable of breaking any laws ever, so it doesn't really matter. The Prince family has done so much damage to the human race.
Oh yeah, pure fucking evil.
Thank you, Michigan. Anyway, on the 14th of July, 1969, El Salvador finally struck. They wanted to, what I assume would be like a World War II carpet bombing to start their mission. One problem, though, they lacked anything resembling heavy bomber aircraft. They weren't able to purchase any of those from the local museum.
Getting like a Lancaster.
So instead, they did the next best thing, which is simply take some of their civilian airliners and modify them to carry bombs, as well as C-47 Sky Trains.
Jesus.
Which is incredible. Now, I say converted pretty loosely here. So these civilian planes, like most people know, like the back opens on most planes, right?
Right.
You've seen footage from like the Syrian Civil War where they just kind of like kick barrel bombs out of planes and helicopters. That's pretty much what they did. They lowered the back of the loading ramp and then just threw bombs out. There were some that were modified to carry bomb racks under their wings, but they were incredibly unsafe because you can't just bolt bombs under the wings of aircraft and expect it to fly right. So they kind of yeeted bombs out the back using that tried and true World War One technique of just kind of eye fucking it.
Yeah. I was talking to Roz at one point. We were talking about the idea of like a hypersonic bomber and how it would be good. I mean, not good, but it would be funny that you could at those speeds just use anything as a bomb.
Right, right.
Dropping MREs out the back, and suddenly they're basically JDAMs.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, listeners who have bought my sci-fi series, like, that's one of the things that I kind of thought of was a space aircraft doing orbital strikes. But they wouldn't, but I'm like, well, they wouldn't really need explosives. So they just, like, fire tungsten rods.
Yeah, rods with the gods, bro.
Yeah, yeah. And because the kinetic force itself would be fucking insane. And so I'm assuming that's what they're going for, because a lot of these bombs did not go off, but they killed a lot of people. And this is because, you know, they were aiming it by, like, eye-fucking it with a Kentucky windage, I believe it's known as. Now, while slapdick and hilariously bad, these bombing attacks worked at hitting the Honduran Air Force while it was still on the ground as a Salvadoran army crossed the border. It was easy for Honduras to know where they were attacking from and what direction they were going, because there's only one road that connected the two across the border. But they were unable to stop this advance due to being badly outnumbered. The Honduran military is pretty much non-existent. They're very, very small, very underfunded. And remember, at this point, they are mostly just used to shoot at Union members. So, like, they're not used to when somebody shoots back.
I'm sorry, we couldn't have Battle of Blair Mountain 2.
Yeah,
sorry. The massacre this time.
While Honduras is getting kicked across the ground, insert soccer joke here.
Damn, dude.
Their Air Force began carrying all of the weight. Honestly, the Honduran Air Force is the most impressive part of this entire war. Honduran ground crews worked fast to repair airstrips and planes, despite the fact that they were bolting together museum pieces. Now, their Air Force is also Mustangs and Corsairs. They use the same kind of thing that the Salvadorans did to acquire an Air Force, because if it's dumb and it works, it's not dumb, right?
That's the damn truth, Joe.
And they quickly got them back in the air. And that is where, for the last time in history, at least so far, piston-powered prop aircraft dueled it out in dogfights that looked like they could have been ripped straight out of World War II.
Hell fucking yeah. I shouldn't be pleased by that. That's fucked up.
We even got one last ace.
Wow.
Honduran Captain Fernando Soto was probably the last propeller-driven fighter ace in human fucking history, within the first day of fighting, shooting down 3 enemy aircraft and killing 2 pilots.
Wow. Oh, that's horrible. You know, pointless war and all, but that's
he was invaded.
Funny.
Like, I'm on,
yeah,
like,
I get it.
Honduras sucks in this situation because, you know, the hate crimes, but they were invaded. Now, the Salvadoran Air Force attempted to use their aircraft as ground support aircraft. Now, for people unaware, this is really hard to do. It requires very highly skilled pilots and communication with the ground. They did not have either of these things.
Nope.
Now, normally, when you call in close air support, you have someone whose sole job is to do that, to make sure that the plane, who cannot see you, doesn't accidentally kill you. Now, the main problem with this is there was no way for the Salvadoran soldiers on the ground to talk to the pilots outside of, you know, the hand-waving signal from Team America, like, do the danger movement type thing. It meant that every time the Salvadorans attempted to call in support for their infantry, they also had to run for their life.
Oh, oh boy. That's a hard way to live, man.
Like, should we call an air support or just let the enemy kill us? Or do we want
like,
the pilot?
I guess. let me eat lunch at least. Like,
and the Hondurans, like, huh, the Salvadorans are running. That must mean their air force is coming.
Does the phrase danger close mean anything to you?
Danger close, also on your head. Now, this is where the Honduran Air Force did what I like to call the Rhodesia move.
Oh, no.
And I mean that, honestly, in the best possible way. For people who don't remember, during the, I believe, the third Chamarenga, I might be the second or third, I don't remember. The Rhodesian strategic fuel depot was destroyed with a single rocket because they had all of their fuel in one place.
That's not smart. Don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that. Anyway, El Salvador did that. So the Honduran Air Force attacked Salvadoran air bases, but their main target was their strategic oil reserve for the entire nation of El Salvador, located in one spot in the port of Acajutla.
I gotta tell you, if it's in one spot, it's not that strategic.
It's not very strategic. Like, oh, look at all that fuel. Look, guys, I'm not saying that, like, you know, if
we're not experts, but
we're not experts here, but I'm going to say, if you're going to start a war, say, as a lark, maybe. Don't store all your oil in one place. Perhaps it's a strategically bad idea. On July 16th, they were on fire. They also targeted supply depots and warehouses. And if that wasn't a big enough fuck you, they blew up power centers, plunging the entire country into darkness with no fuel, and everything is now on fire.
What a bunch of dicks.
This is what is generally known by historians as fucking around and finding out. Now, the Honduran Air Force was pretty much the only part of the Honduran military that did anything to stop the invasion, and almost single-handedly won them the war, because without the Air Force, there's a very good chance that El Salvador just keeps driving till they reach the capital.
Sure.
The Honduran army pretty much broke and ran during every major confrontation, of which there were very few. There was very few land battles. It was mostly just like a rolling skirmish.
Weird. Okay.
Most of the people killed in the conflict were Honduran civilians, as Salvadoran soldiers murdered indiscriminately, not to mention their slapped-together bomber aircraft chucking all random reliable explosives. Yeah.
War crimes.
There was also Honduran civilians who joined in on the war front. Seeing their soldiers break, they decided to pick up whatever weapons they had, sometimes little more than farm equipment, and try to murder the nearest Salvadoran soldier, which is, I admire the pluck, you know?
Right. A for effort.
Yeah, how did Frank die? Oh, hoe to the face. Oh, shit, okay. This began to slow the Salvadorans down, as well as the weather, which began to just pour rain onto them, which washed out the only road, turning into just a morass of mud.
Mmm, tasty.
Eventually, the constant bombardment and destruction of supplies bogged down the El Salvadoran advance, right as they closed in on the Honduran capital. They ran out of gas, so that killed what little mechanization the Salvadoran army had. Because remember, all of the oil just got burned down. Not to mention, like, they had no logistics. As we've talked about time and time again, to win a war, you need logistics. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why, not a great example, but for every, like, combat soldier, the U.S. military has something like a dozen non-combat support soldiers. Because it requires a lot of trucks or people or something with legs to get shit to the front to make war happen, right? El Salvador didn't have any of that. So once the mechanization of the entire Salvadoran military broke down, they were reduced to transporting their soldiers and supplies in the backs of donkeys, which don't move very quickly.
Would you say they were led by donkeys, Joe?
No, they were donkeys, Liam. They were actual donkeys.
All right, well, I guess I'll just go fuck myself. Thanks.
Yeah, you go do that. You double back and get back to the show after you're busy vigorously fucking yourself.
Wow, okay. if you say so, Daddy.
Meanwhile, their soldiers ran out of bullets and food. Again, logistics problems. Also, all of that stuff got blown up too. So, like, we need food and bullets. So do we. Good luck. Meanwhile, the Salvadoran and Honduran army, for that matter, was already desperately poor. Even before everything got blown up, they could hardly supply basic necessities in the best of times, and war made all of that impossible.
It'll get you like that, yeah.
If you were a Salvadoran soldier, your life just got markedly worse when all of your supply depots got blown up, meaning that you had nothing. You had a rifle, sure. Not everybody even got boots. Like, there was not enough food to go around. You had a gun. You had a uniform on your back. That's probably it. Didn't have any water. Didn't have any food. This actually had a trickle-down effect for Honduran soldiers, ironically enough. On the front, soldiers were stealing from the dead in order to score supplies because the Honduran military simply couldn't supply their own soldiers. In one case, a journalist saw a soldier taking boots off another dead soldier because their family back home was too poor to afford shoes. This meant that soon, both militaries ground to a halt, as neither side's soldiers had anything left to loot from the other after a while. Enter the OAS, or the Organization of American States.
Of course. Hello, boys.
Now, they were being begged by Honduras, who was rightfully worried that they were going to get fucking wrecked. Things were going to get worse for them. They started demanding that the OAS demand El Salvador to stop advancing, agree to a ceasefire, and withdraw. Now, while El Salvador demanded reparations and protections for the people Honduras had expelled, it was obvious that a continued war was pretty much impossible for them too. While they were winning, kind of, they were kind of overall hemorrhaging their entire nation on the effort to do so. Remember, they started off desperately poor. They started off with no infrastructure. They started off with like a badly underserved populace. Since then, things had only gotten worse. And they're winning. Like, they're the ones winning.
The phrase Pyrrhic victory comes to mind.
This, of course, is made worse by, you know, the national supply of oil being set on fire, their power grid being blown up, and all of their reserve supplies of food and dry goods being set on fire by the Honduran Air Force, which numbered like 6 planes. So El Salvador finally agreed. They withdraw their forces at the end of the month, though the actual peace deal wouldn't be signed until 1980.
Wow.
This ended what was generally known in the country today as the 100 Hours War, because it was just 100 hours long.
That does what it says on the tin, I suppose.
In just 4 days, around 3,000 people were dead, mostly civilians, and El Salvador's infrastructure was just reduced to nothing. And the soldiers had no idea what they were fighting over. One Honduran soldier, remember, Honduras was invaded, and they still had no idea why. Quote,
right.
We soldiers didn't have a clue. We went to war not knowing what we were fighting for or why. And he was invaded. Like, why did El Salvador invade us?
I thought we were friends.
I knew we hated each other, but damn.
They fuck you too, buddy.
Yeah. This war is one of the more confusing in modern history, as most people who study it come away with serious questions to how in the hell it got so far. Normally, the hate between the two sides' government to deflect away from systemic problems is not uncommon. You see the US do that. You see North Korea. Everybody fucking does this.
Sure.
They constantly point to an outside agitator to distract people from systemic and internal problems. This happens so commonly that people are like, how the fuck did El Salvador end up actually invading them? Now, I found a good write-up regarding how exactly this happened from Duke University regarding the power of nationalist propaganda when it's connected to something like sports, or more specifically, football. Now, the government of El Salvador was in a very, very bad way, looking for an out, and their propaganda machine churned up the will of the people behind something that most people get behind, national sports, but amplify this with being about the World Cup. This is made worse by government propaganda and media. Combine this with racism being drummed up by fruit companies in Honduras, which was also supported by the government. You can see how the Salvadoran government, which remember is a military dictatorship, could use this for their own game. A deflection from running or blaming everything on somebody else as they ran the country into the ground. Now, this is kind of not super different from the Falklands War with sports thrown in. Like, yeah. It was a war that everybody was shocked by, and it was all a distraction from everybody in play. Mexican journalist Luis Suarez states, quote, in Latin America, the border between soccer and politics is vague. There is a long list of governments have fallen or have been overthrown after the defeat of the national team. Players in the losing team are denounced in the press as traitors. There's also that Colombian guy that got murdered after scoring an own goal. So These things happen.
Right.
Also, for some reason, Radio Havana, the state-run Cuban radio station, joined in, spreading anti-Honduran propaganda and supporting the military dictatorship of El Salvador.
That's crazy, dude. No, you know what? No, I don't want that. The comments are going to be terrible.
The only reason I can figure out why this is the case, besides just like trolling, is because the U.S. dominated fruit companies in Honduras. And, you know, destroying them is good. But the U.S. also supported El Salvador. So this one's kind of lost on me, honestly. Sometimes politics get so messy, you just lose the thread of the whole thing. Now, this isn't to absolve Honduras for what they did or even make their government sound bad, because they were. They were clearly willing to blow up their country, people and economy in order to bow to fruit companies and keep power centralized on the very rich, very powerful, rather than doing any real good with land reform that would have actually helped anybody. Now, I have to like point that out because I'm putting a lot of blame on El Salvador here, because they're the ones that actually pulled the trigger and invaded. Because Honduras is never going to invade El Salvador. No fucking way. Not a million years. This is 100% on El Salvador.
Right.
After the war, the military in El Salvador tightened its grip on power through sham elections, mostly. The common market between the two nations was suspended for 2 decades, leading to all kinds of horrible economic problems in the countries that really couldn't afford to have any more of those things than they already had. Now, the El Salvadoran government proved unable to recover from the war. Their government was damaged. Any legitimacy of the government was annihilated. And their population kept spiking from returning refugees. Their devastated infrastructure wasn't ready to support them, if it even was before, which is why 10 years after this war, a lot of the threads that lead from the 100 Hours War directly to the El Salvadoran Civil War would be they're directly connected. Deprivation leads to popular uprising. Also, U.S. would train a Salvadoran death squads just across the border in Honduras.
We are so good at this.
Yeah, we did it. Now, if you think that like this is all in the past, it really isn't. In 2013, El Salvador went back to threatening Honduras over that same territory. So
why?
Yeah, same thing, honestly. Distraction, political gain.
I mean, I know why. Just if.
Yeah, in case anybody was wondering, El Salvador went on to go 0-3 in the World Cup and get eliminated. So,
yeah. Bunch of dicks.
That is the football war, the 100 Hours War. I know I use the word soccer and football interchangeably. I apologize to any
of my... It's soccer, you dumb assholes.
Like, it's weird. I'm not a soccer guy. I don't really care for the sport. I mean,
it sucks, and the people who like it suck.
Jesus Christ.
Only joking.
In my opinion, it's not entertaining to me, but I will say it is certainly more entertaining than baseball.
Yeah, well, watching paint dry is more entertaining than baseball.
Yeah, exactly. I would rather watch me record this podcast than watch baseball.
I feel that.
And I am just staring at a computer screen right now because you are 5,000 miles away or whatever. But that is our episode. Liam, plug your show.
Hi. I'm on Lions Led by Donkeys. It's a military history podcast without slides. And I'm also on Well, There's Your Problem. It's an engineering disasters podcast with slides.
I'm going to put slides in just to fuck with you.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you for supporting the show. This is a bonus episode, so you paid for this. You make everything we do possible. If you could, and you have Kindle Unlimited, you could download any of the Liberty of Death series for free. And if you don't, it's like $1. So maybe check that out if you like military sci-fi. I keep forgetting to pimp our Teespring store. Check out the Teespring store. There's designs on it. Check on the Hell of a Way to Die store. There's also designs from the Lions Led by Donkeys on there. We have our own little collection. It's kind of weird to say that.
Curated for your pleasure.
That's right. And until next time, buy weapons of war from your local museum. Press them into service and do what you will.
But your neighbor. Do a Rand Paul's neighbor.
Oh, God.